youngest admirers, la la la. Which one is that one, la la la? I hold the glamorous life.
Bring up the curtain, la la la. Bring down the curtain, la la la. Bring up the curtain, la la la. I hold the glamorous.
La.
Good evening and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 17th, 2010. My name is James Marino and welcome back. We've been gone for about a month and after the holidays are all over, we've sorted everything out. Matthew, Peter, and I are ready to talk with you about what's happening on the Broadway scene. And so let's get right into it. Peter Felicia can be found three times a week on theatermania.com and also writes for the New York Star Ledger. Hi, Peter.
Good evening.
Also with us, we have Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for talkinbroadway.com and also is a columnist for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew. Welcome back.
Hey, James.
I should say welcome back because Matthew was also traveling over the holiday season. In fact, I don't even know if Peter traveled over the season, but what Matthew did was he was... I guess he went out to the West Coast, and he also went to CES in Vegas, where he caught Jersey Boys. We'll talk a little bit about that later in the show. But right now, our last show was, I think, on the opening night or the night before opening of A Little Night Music, and we hadn't talked about it yet. So let's talk about that. Peter, why don't you bring us up to speed on A Little Night Music?
I'm delighted it's successful. It's doing such wonderful business and not even at discounted tickets. The price of the average ticket is substantially higher than most Broadway shows seem to be getting. It's not an ideal revival in many respects in the sense that the scenery is rather modest. I'm very surprised that the costuming in the first act is all black. Who died? I knew that that was done in that way so the second act everybody could be in white and the contrast would be lovely, sure, but it was a little too dark for me, and the lighting's dark too. That said, it's certainly nice to have it back on Broadway, and while I think Catherine Zeta-Jones is good, fine, an acceptable performance. I don't think she's amazing. Angela Lansbury, however, I think is. She does a wonderful job of really taking you through that character. And what's so interesting is that she's a woman who is going to die by the end of the show. I don't think I'm giving much away. I think most of our listeners are aware of that. And you can watch her calibrate her march to death, so to speak, and you see her getting a little closer to it every time she's in a scene. She has a wonderful moment, too, at the end of the show where she talks about rejecting a suitor years ago because he gave her a wooden ring as opposed to a diamond one, and now regretting that decision. So it's a lovely performance. There are some controversial performances in this show. A lot of people didn't much like Erin Davey as the Countess and Leanne Larkin as Petra, the maid. They were different interpretations, no question. I've seen Night Music a lot. I think this was my eighth production, including one in Scottsdale, Arizona, at a community theater. They were ambitious. Anyway, I found the different interpretations of the roles very substantiated. The Countess was a bit more of a doormat, but it made sense to me, given the fact the way she's been treated, that she doesn't see many options for herself. I found that supportable. Leanne Larkin, I thought, was very good in finding the nuances in The Miller's Son, which is a song I've always felt is beyond the character's ken. It's a little too smart for the character. But I thought she maneuvered it better than many. Aaron Lazar, marvelous voice, wonderful presence as Carl Magnus, terrific. So it's a very nice revival, and it's so wonderful to have an intelligent show doing well on Broadway, though I do suspect that much of this has to do with the fact that we have an Oscar-winning star and an Emmy-winning star. I don't think the Tonys count as much for the people who are going, those Emmy Awards that Angela Lansbury got from her 12 years on Murder, She Wrote, I think is bringing people in along with Catherine Zeta-Jones. But good luck to it.
All right, Matthew, so what do you think of that?
I agree that Angela Lansbury was excellent. I disagree about Catherine Zeta-Jones. I actually liked her a lot more than Peter did. It's a very different kind of performance. She plays a lot younger, but I think it works as kind of being the story of Desiree Armfeld, who's on the cusp of going into middle age rather than well into the center of it, and sending the clowns. And a lot of what she does has to do with the regret and the disappointment, all sort of wrapped up in her not being ready to face not actually being young anymore, even though she still looks very young and behaves very young. So I thought that those two performances worked very well. I was much less thrilled with practically everyone else. Trevor Nunn is the director, and it's interesting that Peter said that thing about everyone's wearing black in the first act and white in the second act, because I have this odd theory about British directors of American musicals that they're afraid of color. Because if you look at Nine, Fiddler on the Roof, the John Doyle shows, they're almost completely bereft of color. They're almost entirely swathed in black and white in terms of the sets and the costumes. And whether or not that's appropriate for night music, I'm not really so sure, but I thought that a lot of the characters were drawn in similar colors, and that the actors and singers weren't really allowed the opportunities to find different hues in them. See, I know that Peter said that Aaron Lazar was a terrific singer in the show, and I agree that Aaron Lazar is usually a terrific singer, but he was almost speak singing a lot of his songs here, as was Aaron Davey, who I didn't like as Charlotte at all. I'll leave that as just a matter of opinion. But she wasn't really allowed to sing Every Day a Little Death, which is her character's big song. And as anyone who saw her in Grey Gardens, or for that matter, A Little Night Music at the White Plains Performing Arts Center earlier last year, knows she's got a fantastic, legitimate soprano voice that borders on coloratura. And to have her in a role that has one song that is barely sung at all, and then to not even let her show off her voice, really suggests that Trevor Nunn is trying to sap the music out of A Little Night Music. And for the most part, that is what happens. We all know that it has an orchestra of 7 or 8 pieces, and that the lead singers are the only ones who are really allowed any sort of momentary vocal showcasing. And even they're very down. They're singing very down. It's really a production that just sort of wants to be there and sort of have its own little evening type thing, but doesn't really want you to come away with the kind of musical comedy experience that I think really sets Night Music apart from most other Sondheim shows. It's the one that really is a traditional sort of romantic musical comedy, and Trevor Nunn doesn't want to let it be that. And I think that that's a big part of the reason that I like Catherine Zeta-Jones and Angela Lansbury, is that they were playing that aspect of the show and finding the brightness and the youth and the kind of musical comedy energy in it, whereas no one else was really doing that. So the production as a whole didn't work for me, but if you can get tickets, and I guess it's probably pretty hard, Angela Lansbury and Catherine Zeta-Jones are definitely worth seeing, because they're giving the show exactly what it needs, even if everyone else, including Trevor Nunn, pretty much isn't.
You know, I was going to ask you, Matthew, I've heard you on many occasions say that Sondheim wouldn't make your personal shortlist of the all-time great Broadway songwriters, but this is a show that you have more affection for than many of the others.
I like A Little Night Music a great deal. Yeah, I think it's very well balanced.
Might it even be your favorite Sondheim show?
I don't know if I would say that, but I think it's very good. I think it's his most commercial show. I think that is kind of borne out by the fact that it had one of the most successful original runs. I think it's the one that people can relate to the most. I think it's one that people enjoy more than the others. I think that it's really a good show for Angela Lansbury and Catherine Zeta-Jones to be in, because it's going to give audiences a chance to really, I don't want to say that it's Sondheim light, because it's really not, because Sondheim doesn't really do anything light, which is a problem when you have something like Bouncer Roadshow, but that's an entirely different podcast. It really is just a case where people can go for the stars and they can enjoy the show, but I just feel that Trevor Nunn isn't giving them as much to enjoy as can be there. The production of A Little Night Music in White Plains that all three of us saw, by the way, yes. I thought that despite the many problems with it, that was a much truer interpretation of the show, as really sort of this light, frivolous lark that has dark undertones rather than a dark, dirgish kind of evening that has moments of comedy in it. And I wish that Trevor Nunn had not gone as far as he did. I think that there's room to play the comedy more seriously and to have it be darker, but I don't think you need to go quite as far as he went.
For those people who saw that, who didn't see that Marvelous White Plains production, to clarify something Matthew had said, Erin Davey, yes, was in it, but she was not playing the role she's playing now. She was playing Anne, the young girl, the young wife in the show, and did a very nice job. And Sheila Smith was really magnificent as Madame Armfelt in that production.
Totally different from Angela Lansbury, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, much more biting, I'd say, especially when she bit into that cigarette holder while speaking and singing at times, which was very, very funny. So anyway, yes, I see your point there, Matthew, that the White Plains production did have qualities that this one didn't, and it's too bad that it wasn't able to transfer in, but the Broadway economics being what they are, you do need those two powers. That's what's selling the tickets, apparently. I don't think it's sending the clowns.
So let's take a tangent for a second here. Peter, you alluded to a favorite Sondheim show. Which would be yours?
Oh, wow. In many ways, this would perhaps not please the master very much, but the first one I ever saw, which was Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, way back in 1962. You know, I just realized the other day that when I saw Funny Thing in 1962, I was 16 years old, and Ruth Cobart played Domina, and she was ancient, you know. And when I saw the revival in 1996 with Nathan Lane, I really thought Mary Testa was much too young to be playing Domina. I recently found out that Mary Testa was 6 years older than Ruth Cobart was when she played the role. But of course, the difference was that Ruth Cobart was 22 years older than I when I was seeing Funny Thing in 1962, while on the other hand, Mary Testa was 6 years younger than I when I saw the revival in 1996. Funny Thing, in many ways, maybe because it was the first one, and a lot of people were saying to me how this guy was going to amount to something even way back then. But of course, it's hard to go against almost any of the others. I mean, by this point in the conversation, I guess I should have mentioned the word Follies, which I think is the greatest score.
I would agree with that, for the record.
But on the other hand, you know, being in Boston and seeing those four shows try out there, Company, Follies, Little Night Music, and Pacific Overtures, were thrilling experiences. So it's hard for me to pick. The only one that really disappointed me, was Into the Woods. Because when I read that all these fairy tale characters were going to meet together, I thought, that's going to be funny. That's going to be a blast. I didn't think he'd have such a serious agenda. I really thought it was going to be a laugh riot from beginning to end. So that one disappointed me a bit. But and by the time Roadshow got here, you know, because I didn't see Bounce ever in anywhere in the, was it two cities it played? Played Chicago and then Washington. I wasn't able to see it in either place. And it was the first Sondheim show since 1965 that I had missed. So by the time Roadshow got here, it almost like didn't even count in the sense of, because I wasn't expecting very much. But yeah, I guess in many ways, Funny Thing, because it's an ambitious score and it's such a lot of fun. So, but boy, it's hard to not say Follies. Ah, well.
We had, after, you know, we talked about Little Night Music was a few weeks ago, the opening of that, and we're just getting caught up. We're also getting caught up on the disappointing closings of Ragtime and Finian's Rainbow. Do you guys have anything you want to say about those?
Well, yes, I am disappointed. I'm not saying I'm surprised necessarily, but I am disappointed. Ragtime was, which I enjoyed immeasurably, both as a show and as a production, did have terribly high expenses. And with nobody in the cast that anybody had ever really heard of, it was going to be hard to sell tickets. Finian's Rainbow, much the same situation. I'm sorry, too, because these are smart shows, and these are shows that aim high. And I'm saddened when so many shows on Broadway don't aim high and find a life, a long life, in fact. But it's funny. I saw three musicals this week that were so smart, amazingly smart. And for two of them, I had been invited by the authors, and they came up to me afterwards and said, well, you know, and I said, they're terrific. You know, there's a lot of great stuff here, but they're so intelligent. I just wonder if you're going to have a tough time getting them on because they're not silly escapist entertainment. So Finian's Rainbow certainly does have a whimsical quality about it and a nice escapist feel to it. But it is an intelligent show that asks a lot of its listeners, especially in its lyrics, which are really quite wonderful. So I'm really disappointed. It would have been a better Broadway, I think, if both those shows had been able to run for a long time. But that's very hard in a post 9/11 era.
Well, I am sorry that Finian's Rainbow didn't run longer. I think that was a pretty good revival that deserved better than it got. I realized that there were problems with it, and that it wasn't really. James, you were the one who said when it was first announced that you didn't think it would be marketable, and I believe that I thought that it would have a chance, and I guess you were right about that. So I am sad that Finian's Rainbow has closed today, as a matter of fact, was its last performance, and that it's not going to be around. It is getting a cast recording, though, which is good. And, you know, I have to say it, that I'm not at all sad about Ragtime. I really thought it was a bad production of a troubled show that needs a lot of help that its director was not willing to give it. I know that Peter has spent a lot of time already tonight talking about intelligent shows. I think intelligent shows can be done very dumbly, and I think that this Ragtime was done very, very unintelligently and very poorly, and I'm not sad it's gone. And I don't think we should encourage bad revivals of even good shows just because they're smart. But, you know, that's me, and I know a lot of people liked it, and
and a lot of people didn't, to be fair.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and I mean, it should never have come up from Washington, D.C. It was not good there, and they made it worse along the way. It looked like a lower-tier regional theater production and behaved like it, and that's not going to fly on Broadway for the most part, I think, especially when the running costs are that high. So I am sorry, but I hope that the failure of Ragtime serves as a lesson of what should not come to Broadway in the future. And if it does, I think everyone will be better off.
Well, it's hard for me to think of a lot of things that are on Broadway and the quality of them. I'm even talking about the quality of production. It really can't be that the level of acting and direction in Ragtime can really be substantially lower than so many of the other shows that are around, especially ones that have been running a long time. Traditionally, shows that run a long time tend to disintegrate, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, but they do. There aren't too many shows where people think the subsequent casts have been superior to the original casts. So I would think that the level of the acting in Ragtime couldn't have been much or any worse, so to speak. And I put worse in quotation marks because, again, I like the performances than much of what's around on Broadway, considering so many shows on Broadway have been around so long. I hear a lot of I haven't been to Chicago in a long time, but boy, anytime somebody goes, he or she rails about how terrible, what awful shape it's in, and so on and so forth. So, I've heard that about a few other shows too, not as much as Chicago, but the people are going through the motions, the energy isn't there, you know, so on and so forth. So I can't imagine that Ragtime was so bad an experience acting-wise or even direction-wise from the other shows that continue to run merrily.
Well, I think that one of the things that I don't want to seem like a Monday morning quarterback for
Especially since it's Sunday night. That'd be
exactly for a closed show. But I felt this way very strongly since they talked about transferring to New York. You look at Wicked and you look at Chicago and you look at, you know, Phantom and these massive, huge success musicals that are out there. And I think one of the things that you have to find the lowest common denominator about them is that the marketing of them is very good. You know, the marketing of Chicago with the women in the lingerie posters all over Times Square and all over the world. In fact, if you can see them in London, you could see them in South America.
I've seen it in Utrecht College where I saw the show, in fact. So, yes, same ads.
The marketing of the show, you know, it tells you something immediately about the show. The Wicked marketing tells you about the show. The Phantom marketing tells you about the show. The Ragtime marketing didn't do it. It was a very interesting, detailed logo, but it stopped there, and it didn't tell you, you know, oh, this is Ragtime. If you went to the non-theater crowd and you say, oh, do you want to see Wicked, they know exactly it's, you know, the Wizard of Oz story, because the marketing people have put this message across. If you say Chicago, the people are, you know, it got a big boost because of the movie, after all, the Chicago marketing did. But also, it's a very the marketing of Chicago is very it traps the viewer and says, I want to go see this show. I don't think that the marketing of Ragtime was what needed to be.
I wonder if they would have done better if they would have shown pictures of each of the three ethnic groups, or at least a representative from each, to show that that's what the show was really about. The clash of cultures and the coming together of cultures. I wonder if that would have helped. I don't know. I would think, by the way, the title would be very enticing. I think the word Ragtime is a terrific word. It's an exciting word. It's a musical word, literally and figuratively. So, I'd be inclined to, if I would drug you public, I think I would be inclined to go see a show called Ragtime, at least investigate the possibilities of it based on that very felicitous word. But anyway, you know, it's funny. I did hear a lot of people along the way tell me that their friends and relatives didn't know what a Phinian was, and they were confused by that word. Okay, fine. But Ragtime is a more inviting word. I would have thought that it would have done a little bit of the marketing for itself just because it's such a nifty word.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and I think Ragtime is a great word. I think that it's a word that can mean so many different things, and it's what I tell people when people ask me to listen to or read a script or listen to a score from a new show, and they say they want my feedback. First thing I ask them before I read the script or listen to the thing, I said, "Who is your audience?" And when they say to me, "Oh, everyone is my," you know, it's a show for everyone. I say, "No, it's a show for no one." Then. The more specific you can get about developing your audience and who exactly is going to be the ticket buyer. And I think that the Ragtime thing was too generic and too general and didn't speak exactly to an audience. And you know, we joke about, you know, the Jackies and the Jekyll and Hyde people and the Renheads and the people that go see Wicked over and over and over, but you can see that this is the demographic that show is selling to, whether, you know, Wicked be selling to the teens and 20s women, and Chicago is selling to an older set, and you know, it's because these people that are on the marketing side of these shows have really defined what their audience is. And you go after that audience very, very hard, and everybody else will fall into place. But when you're too general, you don't have enough money to go up against Avatar. You don't
It could be, but on the other hand, there's never, I don't think, ever going to be a way to do ragtime where you're not going to have a big payroll. I'm hearing about a production in California of Camelot that's going to be small, and I understand that. I think Camelot can be done small because it really is a story essentially about three people. But ragtime, it's hard to eliminate characters. And
I'm not saying you should eliminate them at
all. Oh, I know that. I know that. I'm just saying that no matter what, no matter what the marketing is, however clever, even if they did find the best marketing strategy, that and people say, oh, gee, that is a show I want to see. The fact is, it does suffer from having an enormous payroll. They certainly didn't have to do it with a big orchestra. God love them for doing it. We're all very appreciative that that happened. We need more big orchestras on Broadway. I think it's always going to be a tough show to do. And I bet we don't see it that often in the future. And not just because of the failure on Broadway this year, the economic failure anyway, because it's just so expensive. So
I like your idea, though, of focusing on the group. If there was a marketing campaign that followed Tate and Mother's campaign in Cole House, if there were three separate campaigns that followed those characters, I think that they would have had a much better way to sell tickets to directly to an audience.
Yeah, they might have done it. Yeah, that's. But of course, we won't know, and we may never know again with ragtime on Broadway. I think it is going to be a long time, if ever, that it ever gets revived again. It's highly unlikely. But I was very grateful to have the opportunity to see it again. I always like seeing ragtime. I've even seen it at the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly. Which is currently defunct, but is supposed to be coming back now.
I heard that there was a buyout for the North Shore.
Yeah, so it looks like that's coming back, and I'm happy about it. They did a production that was very nice. And, of course, it must have cost them a fortune, too. It might have been one of the reasons why the place closed. But all in all, I always appreciate the opportunity to see ragtime, and I relish this one just as much as before.
All right. So from shows that are closed to the talk of a transfer, we talked about the Orphan Cycle a couple weeks back, and the rumor has it that it's coming to Broadway in September. What do you guys think? Is it a smart idea to transfer that?
I thought Michael Riedel had actually already debunked that, but maybe the rumor has kicked up again. Okay, disclaimer. I've only seen the first two chapters of The Orphan Home Cycle. I'm seeing the third one this week. I think that the first two evenings or whatever are amazing, magnificent, multiplied by 45 or whatever. I mean, they're really terrific. But what I had heard about the original Broadway transfer was that they weren't going to do the marathons. They were just going to do evening, 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 matinee, evening, et cetera. And I think that would be a big mistake because, again, there are no stars in it. It's a large cast for a straight play. And if there's not some sort of an event wrapped around it, I think it's going to be really hard to get people to come, especially since here where the tickets are $20, so many of the hardcore theater people are going, even if they couldn't afford to go see Ragtime or Finian's Rainbow or something like that. So I think that it's probably not a wise idea. It's a wonderful project. It's really just absolutely astonishing to watch. And if you haven't seen it off Broadway yet, for the love of God, go. It's almost life-changing. It's so good. But I can't see it flying on Broadway. I would feel really sad for anyone who goes to see it but doesn't have the option or the ability to see all three parts of it, whether because they don't have a day to devote to it or they don't, even worse, have three nights to devote to it, because it really is something where it benefits so much from seeing every subsequent element of it that I just think it wouldn't be seen to its fullest advantage. So I don't know if it's a good idea. If it comes, I wish it all the luck in the world, but I don't think it would end much better than Finian's Rainbow or Ragtime did, personally.
I'm confused, Matthew. How did you hear it was going to work on Broadway? I don't follow your schedule.
I had heard that there would not be any marathons, that it would just be chapter one night, chapter two the next night, chapter three the following night, then chapter one again. There wouldn't be any days where they do all three at in a single day, the way they did with Coast of Utopia and the Norman Conquest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what I heard.
Right. I understand. It is very hard to sell three shows, especially with no stars, as opposed to just one show with no stars. So, yes, it would seem to be a poor commercial bet. We could say that, after all, that's Broadway now. But even in 1976 or so, when Norman Conquest opened, and you'd go to the Morosco Theater, God rest its soul, and you would see the big schematic in the lobby telling you what days this one was being done and that one was done. It's so much easier for a theater goer to ignore three rather than ignore one. And the idea of, if I'm not going to see them all, I'm not going to see any of them, and why go to one and not get the full effect of what would happen with three? And this would have to take this would have to be the case here too, I'm afraid. So in a world that is much better, yes, those plays would run and get every award they could possibly get. But I don't think there has been prorated a better buy maybe in the history of Broadway.
Nine hours for $60 or whatever?
You don't, really.
No. Fantastic hours on top of it.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're wonderful. I don't believe there has ever been a better value on Broadway, off Broadway, of course. Let's say in New York theater for your money. I didn't realize right away that it was $20. And when I heard about that a little later, I was stunned, because that stage is packed with people. It has over 20. So, I mean, you know, really, you know, where else could you pay a buck a person in seeing a show? I mean, it just cannot be done. So I imagine this run is close to sold out, so if you don't have tickets now, it may very be hard to get, but I guess it is worth moving heaven and earth to try to do so, because my admiration for the work itself and the production is equal to Matthew's. I like that 45 times remark that he made. That's about right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Also, some news that came out while we were on break was that the Broadway League announced that in 2009, sales for Broadway shows topped $1 billion for the first time. That's $1,000,000,000 for people keeping track out there. That's exciting stuff. And that's, you know, it's really just a subjective number. I shouldn't say subjective. It's what's the word I'm looking for, Matthew?
Yeah. I don't know what you're going for, James.
I'm just saying that it's an unimportant number. It's just
meaningless.
It's a meaningless number, but it's a you know, it's like a milestone that people say, oh, you know, because like 999 million is relatively the same as a billion, but
well, what it really comes down to, as long as they keep raising the prices, there's certainly going to be record-breaking seasons one after the other, and so.
But it's it also seems like even in economic hard times right now, that it still there's long lists, three and four deep, to get a Broadway house these days. You two are going to have a very big, very big spring. You're going to be seeing a lot of shows this spring, the two of you.
Good.
As opposed to previous springs.
But, you know, it is surprising to me. I did expect that Broadway would feel the recession greater than it has. And I guess the need to be entertained really is still out there. But still, in an era where we have wonderful home theaters and DVDs and so many other options, I'm surprised that people are still coming out and paying, I don't think the word ridiculous is inappropriate, prices for a lot of shows. You know, the half price booth long ago ceased being a bargain, and especially since the half price hasn't even become the norm anymore, that you see 20%, 30%, 40% discounts. So, but I guess people just want to come see Broadway shows and to a lesser degree off-Broadway shows. So, but I'm surprised. Are you, Matthew? Did you think that the recession was going to hurt more than it has?
I'm so terrible with the business aspects of the whole thing. I don't know. I guess I probably would have thought that, but really, it just I think, again, it has more to do with the as you said, with the rising of ticket prices than anything else. So there was a press release that went out late last month about Wicked. I think it was right after the holiday weeks, where Wicked had its best week ever, 2.3 million in a single week, which to me is just absolutely unthinkable when a lot of shows can't even get 1 million, as Ragtime and Finian's Rainbow learned, you know. So it's everything's just sort of upside down. It's hard to say exactly what's going on and what's in people's heads, but if Broadway is making money, it'll stick around for a while at least, which I think isn't a bad thing.
Sure.
You know, we all talked when Wicked was out of town and signed up to come into the Gershwin. We were like, oh my God, the Gershwin. It's
indeed.
It's the barn. It's the death nail right. for everybody. And they've turned it around and said, hey, you know, we have, it's the Gershwin, 1,800 seats or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, they have an average ticket price, and that's pretty high, and 1,800 seats, and they're selling them out, and they're doing gangbuster business. And how long is, when did Wicked open?
6 years. It opened 2003.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's just amazing. It's got the legs that it's got, and that's just, you know.
Well, you know, one other thing that Wicked is doing, and Lion King for that matter, now that we're talking about this, I have major problems with both shows, but thank God they're in the Minskoff and the Gershwin, because nothing else can run in there. So if those shows run 20 years in there, it's not like they're preventing other shows from getting houses and having successful runs themselves. So may they both run forever, even though I don't particularly care for either one.
Well, it's very interesting that when I was a kid, the Broadway Theater, I'm talking about the place right on Broadway at 54th Street.
Just closed.
Where Shrek just closed, was the biggest theater at that time. And everybody feared going in there because it was too big, and therefore seats would always be available. And what you really want is a place where you can sell out. So then when seats aren't available, people are really hungry even more to get seats, and it builds the demand for it. And it's interesting, over the years, the big houses have become the desirable ones because, of course, everybody wants to make as much money as possible, just as it's happened on the road, too. Bostonian that I am, it's sad for me to go to Boston and see the Colonial, the Wilbur, and the Schubert Theaters, usually dark, when they used to be always lit when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s. But the Boston Opera House, which has been a refurbished movie theater with many, many, many more seats. And Metropolitan Theater, what it was called when I was growing up, with 4,000 seats. Those are the places shows go now because the demand is greater, for one thing, but also because you can make more money there. So it's so interesting to me to see the Broadway Theater on 54th Street playing host to Promises, Promises, which in its own way is an intimate show. I mean, it's not that big a musical. And it may even suffer from getting lost there. I do think that Young Frankenstein suffered tremendously from being in the Hilton Theater, that if it had gone to a more conventionally sized Broadway musical house, perhaps the St. James, which was lobbying for it, where the producers had been, that they would have had an easier time of it. But comedy doesn't play very well in those big houses. And Promises, Promises may find it has a problem there, reaching back with its comedy way back into the upper stratosphere, where some people are going to be sitting, or choosing not to sit, for that matter.
Well, let's remember that we've talked about this on previous podcasts, I think, that when a Roundabout moved 1776 into the Gershwin, what a disaster that was.
It was.
And Peter and Matthew, have you guys seen any of the gone to shows in any of the really, really large venues out in the hinterlands, the Fox in Atlanta or the St. Louis Muni? You know, Muni, where outdoor and 5,000, 7,000?
Well, ironically enough, and this can segue right into what Matthew saw recently, because I saw Jersey Boys at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, which was the most beautiful theater I've ever been in 48 years of continuous theater going. Oh, what a movie palace. Oh, my God, it's breathtaking. And then the show starts and you struggle to see it. I was in row K or L, one of those, and I felt I was a million miles away. Ironically enough, I saw the same tour in Washington. Washington a couple of months ago. And in the National Theater, which is a conventionally sized Broadway house, probably has about 1,700 seats. And it made all the difference in the world. Again, I was in K&L, but I felt like I was very, very close to it. So, yeah, shows really do suffer there, no question, when they're in the big places. I saw My Fair Lady production in the what was then called the Wang Center in Boston. That's one of the 4,400 seats. And I was way up. And I remember there was a gentleman in front of me who was clapping avidly at certain points. And I thought, this is wonderful. I'm glad he's enjoying the show. But it's almost like your vote doesn't count when you clap up there. I mean, does anybody hear you? The performance really even know you're clapping? I mean, there's something about it that's so removed that it seems to be defeating the purpose of going to a live show. So
that was, you know, Peter did mention he saw Jersey Boys in a few spots. I know, Matthew, you saw Jersey Boys a few weeks ago out in Vegas.
Two weeks ago
in Vegas during CES. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
It's basically identical to the Broadway version. So if you've seen that, you know what you're in for. But the big difference, there are two big differences that I noticed, and they're barely even big, is that one, the intermission is 8 minutes, and it's a break where they play video of cars. Just
cars
driving around and stuff for no reason I can figure out. So there's that. And then the other quote unquote big change is they have two extra video projection screens on the sides of the stage, because the stage is a little bit wider than the August Wilson is in New York. But other than that, the production is identical as far as I could tell. No cuts. Like I said, an intermission, no changes or additions or anything like that. So if you like Jersey Boys and you're in Vegas, then really you're going to probably have a good time. The one thing that I want to say, though, is, well, the cast was uncommonly good. And I think part of the reason for that is that there were some actual New York people involved. Rick Fogno, something like that. He's playing Frankie Valli. He was the original Will Rogers Jr. in the Will Rogers Follies.
Is that right? All grown up.
Answer, Wonderful Town, and yeah, other stuff. And he acts excellently when he's singing in his chest voice. He's really terrific. His falsetto is a little bit feminine or a little bit disconnected. And if you know the real Frankie Valli, or if you saw Jersey Boys when John Lloyd Young was in it, that sound has an edge to it. It has kind of a steel thread going through it that really gives it a masculine sound, even though it's super high and freakishly blasting out the head, and that is kind of missing from his vocal performance. But that was the only complaint that I had about him. The most of the other actors are probably not ones you would know. Jeff Liebau was Nick Massey, which is the J. Robert Spencer role, and I had thought that no one could do anything with that role, and really Jeff Liebau did a lot more than J. Robert Spencer did. He made it much more of an active part of the show. It's still really a bad role, far, far too weak for any show that really has four lead characters. So that's a major problem with the book, I think. The Bob Gaudio is Peter, I don't know how to say his name, Peter Sade or Peter Sadie or something like that, who, unlike the original Bob Gaudio, Daniel Reichard, Peter Sade or however you say his name, is 6'4" if he's an inch. And to see him tower over the others like that, whereas the character is really this kind of mild-mannered, sort of wants to get along with everybody, it really is an interesting contrast. And I guess, judging from the photo in the playbill that they provided with the show, that actually is more historically accurate, because Bob Gaudio was apparently one of the tallest, if not the tallest, of the Four Seasons. But the big... and I can't say discovery because I am very familiar with his work, but the really big delight here was Devin May, who plays Tommy DeVito. I was really not impressed with Christian Hoff on Broadway in that role. But Devon May, who was the original Bat Boy and has done a number of other smaller roles in a number of places, was so good as that character. He really made something of the sort of jerkish but also kind of big brotherly guy that really is responsible for the starting of the group and then its downfall as well. And he really made it a very sincere, very funny, and still very Jersey kind of performance. And his singing is just beyond compare. It always just kind of amazes me when people talk about the best Broadway performance that Devon May is not on the list. And I can only assume it's because he doesn't have a ton of Broadway credits, but he's a fantastic singer. He gave what I think is the single best performance I've ever heard at any of the Broadway Unplugged concerts, where he sang Mark Kudish under the carpet or whatever. Just he's the one problem with him in Jersey Boys is that he's not really that much taller than Rick Falgano. In fact, he might even just be the tiniest bit shorter. So to see him try to exert all this force over the others, where he has no vertical height to back it up, and that's not necessarily a problem, but I think it might be part of the reason he hasn't gotten more roles, because he's really a fantastic actor and he's just an amazing singer, whether he has a microphone or not. And he really should be a bigger star, and I hope the Jersey Boys is giving him the exposure he needs to make that happen. The actor who played Joe Pesci in the Las Vegas version was very unsatisfying. The original guy who did it on Broadway had the accent down perfectly, and you kind of knew even before they said that it was Joe Pesci who it was. And here he's not even trying to do the accent. So that was the only real disappointment with the casting, as far as I was concerned. The problem with Jersey Boys is that if you're not one of the four guys, or Bob Crewe, who also, you know, co-wrote the lyrics, and he is played here by John Salvatore, who is very good. I don't know his work at all. If you're not one of the four lead guys, you're really not doing anything, and that really is a tremendous problem with the book. The female characters are extremely underdeveloped. I still think that there are a lot of parts in the story where things don't quite connect the way they should, and I don't think it's a great book, but there are parts where Des Makinoff's direction really makes it an electrifying experience to watch, and it's not as kind of invigorating an experience as the original Broadway one was, just because everyone there was so fresh and sharp and everything. But the choreography by Sergio Trujillo is still excellent. It's one of those wonderful things where it doesn't look like they're dancing, but of course they're dancing very much, and there's nonstop movement, and it's a very interesting example of how to do a jukebox musical as if it were a new show. It's not ever going to be a great show, but it really, it's a lot of fun, and I enjoyed the opportunity to see it again. I can't imagine I'll have another chance in New York, because it's still selling tremendously well. And I saw it on a Tuesday night in Las Vegas, and the house was not full. It was very, it gave it a darn good shot. Upwards of 3/4, I'm sure, of the seats were sold. And I think it was probably slightly bigger than the August Wilson. It's certainly wider. I don't know how far back it went up in the mezzanine, but it's probably a little bit bigger than that. And there were pockets in the orchestra that were empty, but otherwise it was doing pretty well. So I think that the show is doing okay. And if you get a chance to go to Las Vegas and you're looking for something to see, it's faithful. And in terms of the casting, it's pretty darn good.
What I love about the Jersey Boy book is that it gives us the confidence they're telling us the truth. I'm not saying they are. I think that might even be too much to ask, and I'm not even sure that anybody even knows what the truth is. But the fact that early in the game, they let us know that guys went to prison, the guys in the who are supposed to be our heroes did bad things, gives us the confidence to believe this is not going to be a whitewash. And I think that's a very courageous thing. And I like that very much about the book. And the structure is wonderful by getting four different points of views from four different guys, and setting it is spring, summer, fall, and winter, was a very great stroke of luck, because of this group were called the Four Lads. That wouldn't have occurred to the writers, but they did have that that break on their side. Nevertheless, even with that break, the idea of letting us believe they're telling us the truth in a way that most shows don't. One of the things that Lennon was tremendously criticized for a few years ago when it was on Broadway was that it wasn't telling us the truth, that a lot of people knew stories, but Yoko Ono was there and she wouldn't allow the truth to be told and all that. And when you do that, you do something else that neither likes at all, in essence, you know, that the audience feels it. But here you somehow at least are seduced into believing they're telling you the truth, and that's a very skillful thing about it.
The other thing that's really, there are two really interesting ways about the way Jersey Boys is constructed that I think have to do with the fact that it does seem to attract people who are put off by Mamma Mia, and by people, I of course mean me. But really, he uses very few songs as dramatic statements. Most of them are sung as songs. And I think that when you have a jukebox musical where, by definition, the songs cannot relate to the character, that really does make a big difference, because they're not pretending. And as I've said in both of my reviews now, including the Las Vegas one, which is up on BroadwayStars.com/Matthew, every time, and it only happens two or three times, that Jersey Boys tries to do that, it just gets too stupid to even watch, basically. And I think that if they had done the entire show with no lapses as completely diegetic numbers, that it would really be considered even more successful and kind of daring than it actually is. And the other aspect of it that I think is really interesting and very kind of smart, and Peter, I believe that you might have brought this up a long time ago, and if you did, I'm sorry to steal your point.
No.
But basically, what they do is, for the first half hour or so of the show, the lead guys only sing other people's songs. They don't sing any real Four Seasons songs for really until well past the first, well, no, I shouldn't say that, but until about the halfway mark of the first act. I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Earth Angel, My Mother's Eyes, Cry For Me, and all of that stuff. And it all has a very certain feel and a certain sound and a certain kind of loungy bounce to it that matches what they were doing. And then the instant that Sherry hits, which was their really breakout song, the entire sound of the show changes. It's just like there's a bang, like a door is slamming and everything else is changing. And it's really very smart for them to do it that way, to bring you into the show so gradually, to show where they came from and how their sound is so completely different from the other ones that came before. And what I said in my review is that the thing people remember about Jersey Boys are the moments. And really, the moment when the four guys stop singing other people's songs and start singing their own with Sherry, it really is just one of those things that just hits you as like, wow, this is what the show has been missing. This isn't, I didn't realize what was going on, but yeah, this is really what the show needed. It really is their sound, and I'm being convinced that they weren't singing the right kind of thing. It's so well done in that way, and it's not kind of the daring sort of thing that other jukebox musicals have done. And really, most jukebox musicals just want to play it safe. They just want to give people the hits and get them out the door, and they don't care how they get there. And that has been one of my big problems with Lennon and Mamma Mia and All Shook Up and so many of the other shows that do that. And Jersey Boys avoids that to a great degree. And while I do not think that the book overall is very good, I have to give Rick Elise and Marshall Brickman credit for, along with director Des McAnuff, for making that choice and having them ease into the Four Seasons music the way they did, because there's no reason for them to. Any other show would have done it more conventionally, and it wouldn't have been as interesting or as powerful as it is. So I think that they really do deserve credit for that, and for making Jersey Boys one of the rare jukebox musicals that comes really darn close to working completely as legitimate theater.
I agree. It's a musical that doesn't have music that I particularly listened to when it came out. And it is a jukebox musical. And yet I begrudge it none of its success because I really think it did so many things right. And I wish it well. And have since the moment I saw it. So
what's happened in the past is a lot of shows that have gone out to Vegas have kind of gone under the knife and had a transformation. Did you notice anything in Jersey Boys?
No. As far as I could tell, it was a complete show except for the 8-minute intermission or a break, as they call it. The house lights, as I recall, didn't even come up full. They just came up to half, and then there's a projection on the mid screen that said break 8 minutes, 7:59, 7:58, etc.
Oh, really? There was a countdown, like the drive-in movies. Wow.
Yeah, so I have a feeling that they thought that the people wouldn't be expecting that there, and so they felt they had to kind of give them that hint. And maybe that's a good idea because, James, as you said, a lot of the other shows that have gone into Vegas, except, I want to say, which I didn't see it there, but I have heard Mamma Mia was the complete two-act version because, of course, you can't possibly tell a story that complex in just 90 minutes,
whatever you do.
But, yeah, so I think that what works in Jersey Boys' favor in that department is that it is very much Vegas-y in its structure and its intent of celebrity, quote-unquote, impersonation.
Sure, sure.
So that's, I think that probably helped it avoid the knife, as it were.
What day of the week did you see it?
Tuesday.
You saw it Tuesday, because I'm noticing they have a 6:30 and a 9:30 on Tuesdays. So they probably can't have a long intermission because they'll go right up against that 9:30 start.
What's also interesting about that 8 minutes, 7:59, 7:58 is I think that's also a way of saying, if you're going to leave, leave now, because if you're going to gamble, you don't have much time to do it. So, we're letting you know that you don't have very much time, and that's probably a good thing. Matthew, what were some of your other choices? What might you have seen out there? What's playing out there besides Jersey Boys?
Phantom is still there. I saw that last year or the year before, though. So I didn't want to see that again. I didn't have a lot of choices because, as James said, I was out there for CES and that.
No, I know, but I mean, did you notice what else was playing? That's all I'm asking.
I could have seen Menopause the musical. I think I made the more appropriate choice for me. Let's say. There wasn't a lot else out there that I really.
One of the things to say, Matthew, is that Phantom is actually also at the Venetian. Jersey Boys is at the Venetian, isn't it? Or Palazzo?
Jersey Boys is technically at the Palazzo,
which is
connected to the Venetian.
Well,
a separate
same. Yeah, and that they built the theater for Jersey Boys, and they built the theater for Phantom.
It's called the Jersey Boys Theater, so yeah.
Is it really? Wow.
And,
And one of the things about these 8-minute intermissions is that, unlike Broadway, they have vast bathroom facilities everywhere in Vegas. So this is not like you're going to stand on a line to get in and out of a bathroom.
That's great. It should happen more often.
Yeah, you know, they probably have more bathrooms than we have seats in us in the Helen Hayes. Pretty small theater. All righty. So I think that wraps it up for our first show of 2010. And I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, we're in the Broadway Radio section. There's a subscribe link. And also right there, you can reach out and contact us by using the email form at the top right-hand corner of every page on BroadwayStars.com. Let us know what your thoughts are or about what we're talking about. And also, if you feel so inclined, you can call and leave us a voicemail at 646-873-7695. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.